the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest on the program today is Roy Williams, and he will discuss with us, and of course with you, the listener, five steps to successful transfer of wealth to your heirs. This is an important topic. If you remember a few weeks back here on the show, we actually opened this whole conversation, and so I think you're going to find this important information. Here we are. We have marched into the month of December. It's that time of year when the holidays are upon us and when everybody gains at least 50 pounds. The exchange of gifts with friends and family. It's also that time of the year, believe it or not, when we talk about giving to others who are less fortunate. So today, discussion is about charitable giving and passing on a legacy to your heirs. This week, billionaire Mark Zuckerberg and his wife vowed to donate 99% of their $45 billion fortune to charity. Zuckerberg joins fellow billionaires Warren Buffett and Bill Gates in donating their vast fortunes to charity. So we're going to focus on gift giving and how to pass a legacy to your heirs that is meaningful, at the same time maintaining family harmony and ensuring the smooth transition of the intergenerational wealth. So both parts of today's program are related. We're going to cover charitable giving in part one of the show. Then we'll have an interview with the author of Preparing Heirs, Five Steps to a Successful Transition of Family Wealth and Values.
Yeah, I wanted to cover charitable giving today, John, because it's a great tax-saving strategy that also it does a lot of public good, because we're talking about charitable gifting. And of course, the big news this week on Wednesday, Mark Zuckerberg, his wife gave birth to their first daughter, and they made that announcement that he's going to be, over their lifetime, donating 99% of their Facebook fortune, which is valued at least this week at somewhere around $45 billion. Fascinating. And the guy isn't even age 30 yet. But there are many ways to do this when we think of charitable gifting, from making cash donations, let's say, you know, like, for example, tithing to your church or your favorite charity, or in other ways, donation of assets, especially those that have appreciated immensely.
Well, what about the tax implications of making charitable gifts? That's one of the things that people always examine when they're discussing this.
Yeah, I mean, if you're making a simple cash gift, it's pretty straightforward. You write a check for, you know, $1,000, $10,000, whatever it is. Although you should check with a tax advisor, because you want to be careful with AMT or the possible loss of part of your deduction as a result of the Tax Reform Act of 2012. We've talked about that on a number of issues. But if you're donating an appreciated asset, think of Mark Zuckerberg, and for example, his Facebook stock, maybe you were fortunate enough to buy Apple stock or Google, whatever it is, or maybe you have appreciated real estate. Real estate gets a little bit more complicated. But it's really, and I want to stress this, advisable to check with an advisor, because there are great benefits to doing this. But the laws are very complex, and especially if you're donating appreciated property like real estate with debt associated with it. So by all means, at least talk to your advisor before making gifts of appreciated property. I don't care if it's a stock, a closely held business, or an interest in a business, or real assets.
Now, I know, Jim, in the past, you've talked about certain kind of tax trusts. This really interests me. Tax trusts where you can make charitable gifts, get a deduction for it, and at the same time still maintain an interest, or at least receive some of the benefit from the asset or the gift that is made. Now, that's intriguing, because usually when something is tangled up with taxes, you lose a certain amount of control over it.
Yeah, this is something that was set up by Congress, and it was, John, actually to encourage gifting, the kind of gifting that you have seen so many of these wealthy people do. But you're referring here to something we call a charitable remainder trust. Now, there are a number of ways this is done, And in many cases, it's done with a wealth replacement trust. But this trust itself has its own complexities, and it really depends on the goals that are defined by the donors. In this case, let's say a husband, a wife, or maybe a surviving spouse.
All right, so let's talk about the use of charitable trust. How does it work? That's the first thing. Like, is it some big complicated mechanism that then is going to cause me a lot of grief? But assuming that it doesn't, what are the advantages of it?
What a charitable trust does is it allows an individual to make a substantial deferred gift to a favored charity, but they retain a right to receive payments or income from the trust. So under the right circumstances, the use of, let's say, a charitable trust offers all kinds of multiple tax advantages to individuals who make the gift of the appreciated property. And the reason it's a deferred gift, and that's where hence it gets its name, a charitable remainder trust, because during the lifetime, usually during the lifetime of the donor, and it may even be a succeeding generation, the family still has an income or a retained income interest in the trust. So the charity is going to get the gift or the asset somewhere down the road based on the life expectancy of the donor or maybe even a succeeding generation if that is used.
And the advantages of doing this, the tax advantages?
Well, I mean, let's make this simple since this is a podcast. Let's say you have an appreciated asset. Let's say you had the foresight to buy Netflix, Apple, Google, Facebook, whatever it is. But let's say that if you sold the stock, assuming, you know, it's going to be in a high tax bracket, let's assume that you have, in this case, $1 million of capital gains. Now, here's the problem. The federal tax on that $1 million of capital gains is 23.8%. And here in California, based on the various tax rates, they would be up from 9.3 to 11.3 on that $1 million. So you would owe $238,000 in federal capital gains taxes. And then you would owe the state of California $102,000. So John, on that $1 million capital gain, you owe the government and the governor $338,000. In this case, the owner of the stock would lose that $338,000 in taxes, so obviously you have less money to invest. There could also be, depending on the size of your estate, there could be estate taxes down the road that are as high as 40%. So if the $1 million stock is put in a charitable trust, the trustee could turn around, sell the stock, pay no capital gains or state income taxes. In addition, and here's where it gets really nice, in addition to the capital gains tax savings, the donor would also receive a substantial tax deduction for making the gift that could be then used to offset, let's say, your ordinary income and save on income taxes. So by donating the stock to a charitable trust, John, the donor would save three kinds of taxes. The capital gains taxes, in the example I just gave, the $338,000, you wouldn't have to pay that. There would be income tax savings, as you would get a $1 million deduction or part of that because the charity is not going to get it right away. And it gets a little complex in terms of how much of a deduction you get based on your age, when the charity gets it, the amount of income that you get from the trust. But there is income tax savings, so that's a second tax. And if your estate is large enough, you could actually save on estate taxes. So, you know, think of this. Capital gains taxes of 23.8%. Here in California, the state income taxes are 13.3, so you're almost talking about 37% in income taxes. Then a tax deduction, depending on your tax bracket. Let's say today you can be in a 44% federal bracket. You could be in a 13.3 here in California. So there's 57% in income tax savings on the amount that you can deduct against your income. And then there's the estate taxes that you would also save, which could be as high as 40%. So you can see here, there's a lot of ways, actually three different ways you can benefit from tax savings here.
Okay, now, as I mentioned before, usually you lose control when you do tax donations, etc. But what about the use of the asset? I mean, does the owner lose his control? What if they want to earn income during their lifetime?
Well, this is where we talk about the charitable remainder trust, because if you were just to donate, let's say, an asset outright to charity, yes, you would avoid the capital gains, you would avoid the estate taxes, you would get the income tax deductions as well. But suppose, for example, in this case, the $1 million, let's say you were thinking, well, gee, I don't want to pay all these taxes. I like the income tax benefits, but I also want to, you know, get some income on it and live off this during my lifetime. That's the great advantage of donating assets to a charitable trust, because at the time the gift is made, usually you take a fixed percentage of the asset value each year. So in this case, let's say you could take a 3% rate of return. And in this case, under $1 million, 3%, the donor would get $30,000 a year, or 3% in terms of whatever the value of that asset would grow. There are other types of charitable remainder trust where you actually get a fixed amount each year that's set. So there are a number of ways that you can do this depending on the income needs of the donor. The other thing you don't forgo, let's say the stock was sold, and in this case, the money was reinvested in blue chip stocks that pay more of an income, you know, let's say utility stocks or consumer staple stocks, energy stocks, where the dividend yields are 3, 4, and 5%. You would also get that 3% distribution rate on the value of the trust. So as the assets were growing, let's say, for example, you donate $1 million today, and 10 years from now, the value of that trust is worth, let's say, $2 million. Well, you'd be getting 3% of the $2 million, not the original $1 million. So in that case, when it grew to $2 million, you'd be getting $60,000 a year. Actually, I had a client, John, where they sold their business to a public company in 1999 for $4 million in public stock. We transferred that stock to a charitable remainder trust. We avoided the capital gains. We also got substantial income tax deductions, which were used over the years to draw down the IRA and minimize the taxes. But we also avoided $1.2 million in federal and state income taxes at the time we set up the trust. Back then, we set up a 4% distribution rate, and originally that was $160,000 a year. Today, John, that trust is valued at over $10 million, and the annual income distribution is over $400,000 a year. So not only did they save the $1.2 million, in this case, on taxes up front, when they avoided the capital gains, they also saved substantially on income tax deductions that they got, which they used to offset the drawdown of his IRA. And then on top of that, they're going to save substantial amount of assets, 40% on the estate taxes. And today, his widow is receiving over $400,000 in income from that trust that was originally set up at $4 million.
Okay, in the case we're talking here, where, say, $4 million was donated in appreciated stock, and then it eventually matures to greater than $10 million. But if I understand how this works, the assets go to a charity and not to the heirs. Now, what do you do if you want the heirs to receive part of the assets from this?
Well, I mean, there's several ways that you can structure this. The distribution could be extended beyond, let's say, a husband and wife, their lifetime, to the heirs. Now, the further out that you extend when the charity receives it, the lower is going to be your upfront income tax deduction. You're still going to save on the capital gains. That's still there. You're still going to save on estate taxes. That's still there. But the income tax deduction that you're going to get up front would be less. So say, for example, you had a couple kids. You could say, all right, in this charitable trust, as long as the husband and wife live, they're going to get this check. In the case of the $1 million, the 3% of that. But also, I want it to go to my two children during their lifetime. You could do that. The other method used that we do sometimes, in fact, we do this a lot, is we set up a wealth replacement trust. And you'll see that in the case study that we're doing today, which is funded with insurance. It's an insurance policy. Normally, you get a last survivor policy based on husband and wife. When the last spouse passes away, the life insurance proceeds go to the heirs income tax free and estate tax free. So at the death of the donors, the charitable trust assets would go to the charity, not to the kids. However, the wealth replacement assets let's say the proceeds from the life insurance and the wealth replacement trust would go income tax-free and estate tax-free to the heir. So basically, you could almost replace the asset. So it's a very powerful combination. We often see this used by super wealthy families, from the Kennedys to other wealth legacy families that we read about or hear about in the news. It's a real favorite tool of mine, especially when you get into larger estates, because there's so many tax advantages that come about. You save on capital gains, you save on income taxes, you save on estate taxes, and also, depending on the goals of the donor, you can extend the payments to the heirs or simply replace the assets through a wealth replacement trust.
And why do you use this type of a strategy? Would it be a fair guess to say it's normally when there are major assets or capital gains?
Yeah, I would say if you want to just, you know, donate $20,000 of stock or something like that, you're probably just better off donating it to the charity. This strategy is probably really appropriate when there are substantial capital gains, and usually when you get to the larger estates. Once you get beyond 10.8 million, you're going to be subject to 40% estate taxes, not to mention the capital gains taxes. So there's a lot of planning that needs to be involved, from tax planning, estate planning, investment planning. So a lot of thought needs to be given on setting this up because of all of the tax and investment implications I talked about. I mean, we have three different kind of taxes: capital gains taxes, income taxes, estate taxes, not to mention the investment strategy you're going to want to choose to make sure that, you know, the assets are preserved during the donor's lifetime, that the income's there and that you're going to receive the income. So, John, a lot of planning, but I would say, you know, this is really appropriate for those individuals that really have large estates and especially large appreciation in an asset, usually a stock. It could be a business, a piece of real estate, but substantial capital gains that you want to avoid.
And I would imagine here that if you do have substantial capital gains or maybe a large estate, this is definitely a strategy that you should explore. But you also want to make sure you explore this with professionals. This is not a do-it-yourself kit type of strategy, unless you happen to be a tax attorney. All right, let's move on to related topics, which is teaching heirs about creating a legacy. And this is important because if you pass certain amounts of wealth off to your heirs and they don't know what to do with it, they may just simply destroy it in a short amount of time. What we're going to be doing is going into this in depth with Roy Williams, who is the guest here on today's program, preparing your heirs to receive great wealth and the responsibilities that it entails and how to preserve it. So I don't want to take anything away from that.
Jason Stevens always got what he wanted.
Do you have any idea who I am?
But his grandfather had other plans.
So what's in the box?
Your inheritance.
Now, if he wants to discover the ultimate gift...
I want to give you a series of gifts. If you fail in any way, you get nothing.
He'll have to go farther.
Hey, city boy.
You don't look like you worked a day in your life.
I do manual labor for a month?
Try harder.
Don't begin to live until you've lost everything.
No, no, please!
And give more.
Don't you come back at the end of the month with one true friend
than he ever thought possible.
So this is hell.
I've been watching you. You're not a real bum.
Sorry to disturb you.
Hey, I need a friend.
Based on the best-selling novel by Jim Stovall.
Are you Jason's friend?
We're like this.
He's weird, isn't he?
He's a good weird.
Take that money and bid it on someone experiencing a real problem. Put yourself in their shoes.
James Garner, Brian Dennehy, Drew Fuller, and Academy Award nominee Abigail Breslin.
What's your dream?
My dream was a perfect day, and I'm just finishing it.
The ultimate gift.
I don't know if I have my own dream, but I do know I can help others fulfill theirs.
You know, that is one of my favorite movies. It was The Ultimate Gift, and I highly recommend a great movie to watch during the holidays. It was basically about a billionaire oil man who basically his children were sort of like trust fund kids. They weren't really doing much. They weren't being responsible. And his real hope was with his grandson. But his grandson was wealthy because of gifts he had made. And what he really wanted to do was teach him things about friendship, about helping others, about the value of work. And it's a movie, John. I actually have several copies. I usually get a copy of this movie and I give it to my clients to watch when they're considering legacy planning, especially when you're talking about charitable gifting, a charitable remainder trust, or let's say creating a legacy, as we'll talk about in today's case study. I mean, there's so many instructional qualities to this movie. And I highly recommend it. If you are one of those fortunate individuals where you have a large estate, this film, along with the book, Preparing Heirs, gives you some really good guidelines to consider when you want to create a legacy and a fortune and you have immense wealth or a large degree of wealth. You want to create that wealth and make sure it becomes a legacy that's passed on to future generations and remains. We discussed, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, and I'll talk about this with my interview with Roy Williams, author of Preparing Heirs. And it really surprised me, the Vanderbilts, the original founder of the Vanderbilt fortune, considered one of the wealthiest men in the United States in his day. By the time that wealth got down to the third generation in the 70s, there wasn't even one Vanderbilt that was worth $1 million. You know, picture somebody like Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or Mark Zuckerberg. By the time it got down to the third generation, there's nothing. Not one of them is a millionaire. And so we're going to be talking about that with our guest, Preparing Heirs. But it's one of those movies I highly recommend. It's called The Ultimate Gift. They even have a website. It's a fabulous, uplifting movie about tremendous wealth and the good it can do with instructions.
And we'll be talking to Roy Williams in just a second here on the program. But first, it's time for our case study to demonstrate some of the principles we have been discussing here. As with all of our case studies, they're based on real life events, but we change the names to protect the privacy of the people involved. So who's on deck this week?
Yeah, this is really a case study that involves legacy planning. The parents, we'll call them Robert and Helen Grant, $16 million estate, but they had two sons that started a business. It was a software business, and the value of that business, John, is probably, I would say, worth over 30, 40 million. It's still going strong. So obviously, not only did the parents have tax problems, both income tax problems and estate tax problems, but also their two sons who started the business together, they're going to have income tax and estate problems. And the last thing they needed is to inherit mom and dad's money. So basically, we started out with $16 million. And we set up, basically, in this case, a generation skipping trust. Now, to understand the way this works, most people are familiar with an A and a B trust. What happens is when the first spouse passes away, usually you split the trust in two trusts. Typical AB trust, $5,430,000 is where the exemption is today, meaning you can pass $5,430,000 estate tax-free to your heirs. Now, what we did in this is, obviously, the two sons didn't need mom and dad's money. They were wealthier than their parents, making more money, had an estate that was twice, if not three times as large as their parents. So what we did is we set up a generation skipping trust. So on the death of the first spouse, the exemption amount, currently $5,430,000, or the B trust, would go and skip the two sons, and it would go to the grandchildren. So that's $5,430,000. Now, on the death of the first spouse, assuming $16 million, that would leave $10,570,000 in the A trust. Now, when the second spouse dies, that spouse also gets an exemption of $5,430,000. So whatever that exemption amount is going to be going to the grandchildren in a trust set up for the grandchildren. So basically, you're going to have $10,860,000 that will bypass the two sons, and it'll go directly to the grandchildren, skipping one generation. By the way, this was what was used in combination with the wealth replacement trust that was used in Jacqueline Onassis's estate. Her estate at death was valued somewhere around $200 million. She bypassed her children and set up that estate so it goes to her grandchildren. And that's why, even though Joe Kennedy died, I think, in the late 60s, early 70s, I'm not sure when, it's why you have 59 families today and the Kennedy fortune is still there because of this type of planning. Let's get back to this case. So when the first spouse passes away, the amount of the exemption, the B trust, in the Grant's case, $5,430,000 is going to go into a generation skipping trust. That leaves roughly about $10.6 million in the A trust. Assuming Mrs. Grant is going to be the survivor, when she passes away, her exemption is $5,430,000. That will go to the grandchildren, and then the remaining, there will be a $2 million estate tax, roughly about $2 million, and $3 million will go to their two sons. So what we're doing, John, here is we're creating a legacy. And we're talking with the two sons, we may do something even similar because they like the idea of creating multi-generational wealth. You know, they saw the movie. I gave the Grants the movie, The Ultimate Gift, which was a big motivator in terms of coming up with this plan. So we're actually doing three generations. And John, it's not hard to conceive, by the time it gets down to the grandchildren, you could be talking about $100 million estate with the grandchildren, or even going beyond a generation beyond that, very much like you see the Rockefellers and the Kennedys today. This is kind of the way that you set up these larger estates and create the legacy of these families. And it really takes a lot of planning. It takes the kids getting along, understanding what is being done here. There's got to be family unity. There's got to be a statement of values, which I'll get in when I talk with my author and guest, Roy Williams, next. But here you have, John, a trust that is being set up that will pass assets that will continue to grow and grow over the years and become, well, it's already a large fortune today, but become even a greater fortune down the road. So whenever you hear about these families like the Rockefellers, the Fords, the Kennedys, this is one of the tools that they use to pass on this kind of generational wealth.
And speaking of passing it on, coming up next, Roy Williams is our guest, preparing heirs, five steps to successful transfers of wealth to your heirs as lifetime income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, we've all heard about the great American fortunes, from the Carnegies to the Rockefellers to the Kennedys. Great fortunes that have been passed on over time, billions and billions of dollars. But it may surprise you that some of the wealthiest families are no longer wealthy. Joining me on the program is the co-author of a new book called Preparing Heirs, Five Steps to a Successful Transition of Family Wealth and Values, Roy Williams, and also from the Williams Group, Amy Castoro. You know, the thing that really surprised me, Amy and Roy, and this led me to getting your book, I was reading an article that talked about the Vanderbilts, where Cornelius Vanderbilt, at one time considered one of the most wealthiest men in the country. By the time it got down to the third generation in the 70s, none of the Vanderbilts were millionaires. That really shocked me.
It's a statistic we see happening pretty regularly. It's unfortunate, but painfully true across the globe.
Now, both of you, Roy, I know you've done this. You've done extensive surveys over 20 years in research of 2,500 family interviews and studying this great wealth, it's amazing. Is there something that really stands out about why this is so? In other words, why almost 70% of the cases end up in failure by the time you get to the second and third generation?
Well, Jim, let me just give you a little quick background. It doesn't surprise you when you understand the history of this event. If you remember the story of the prodigal son, that's over 2,000 years old, and not talking about the forgiveness side of the father, but the unprepared heir who went out and dissipated his wealth is over 2,000 years old. Also, the brother who did not want to accept him back was not prepared. Today, in China, they call it Fubu Goi Sandai. In Italy, they call it from the stall to the stars, down back to the stall. In every country, in every economic entity in the world, and I just learned within the last 90 days that in Bangladesh, they call it great breakfast and no lunch and no dinner. Well, if that's happening, and it's been going on for more than 2,000 years, why is this occurring? That's the question, because it goes right back to this is an age-old problem. So the next question is, how do we find out why is this occurring? And I talked to one of the major deans. I took summer school classes from him, the dean of the Law School of Berkeley. Again, went to all over the United States and said, what's causing this problem? And without exception, they all told me, and Jim, looking at your history, you'll relate to this, develop the strategy and structure around governance, preservation, and taxes. Those have to be your focus in order to make sure the assets are transferred to the either the trust or heir or whatever the case may be. Guess what? That is so successful. Something like 98% of the lawyers, and accountants, and advisors actually get the money and the assets where their family wants them to go. Isn't that wonderful? Well, if that's true, why do we have a 70% failure rate after they receive it? Nobody's been addressing that issue.
Amy, when you coach families and things like that, we talked about the 70% failure rate. What are the main underlying causes of failure? Because you're talking in many cases, whether it's the Vanderbilts, of some great sizable fortunes. Most of these people are smart enough when they made that kind of money. They hire the best tax lawyers, the best tax accountants. So they have the structures. What happens when it gets down to the heirs? Can you explain that to me?
It's pretty consistent across the board for what we see. One of the main reasons is trust and communication, where what's breaking down is an inability for the family members to be able to articulate what it is that they want to have happen in their family. They're not quite skilled on how to have the important conversations that they want to have. Roy, what's the percentage that represents?
Breakdown of trust and communication within the family, that's a weighted 60%.
So that's the majority of the reason of why these things break down. The second percentage is 25%, which is that the heirs are not prepared. They're not aware of what's actually going to be transferring to them, and they're not prepared on how to handle it when it lands on their lap.
It's bigger than just to prepare about the assets.
Yeah.
That's one of why I don't want to get us involved in preparing the assets to be managed. Uh-huh. It's being accountable and responsible. And they can be accountable and responsible for being at home for dinner on time and develop trust and reliability on a fundamental, very basic basis. And that's weighted 25% when the heirs are not being held accountable and responsible. And the third factor is purpose or mission. What is the long-term purpose for the wealth? What is wealth? Is wealth stocks, bonds, real estate, business interest? Or does it also include the background, the experience, and the passions and interest of the kids, their spouses, grandchildren, and their spouses? If you can get everybody on the same page talking about what's important as a family, our values, and develop a long-term purpose and a mission using those values, all of a sudden, instead of the wealth being the driver, it's our family that's the driver, and it just blossoms into this magnificent bouquet of a family. Truly, magnificent transformation. We see it every day.
Yeah, because, I mean, you take a well-known American family like the Kennedys, Joe Kennedy building a substantial fortune, but the subsequent generation all went into public service, whether it was the sons, you know, JFK, Robert, and Ted, and even some of the succeeding generation going into public service. I want to talk about, are any of these failures beyond the family's control? In other words, is there some kind of outside force or a factor that prevents this wealth from being turned into a legacy for multiple generations? Are there any outside factors that have caused that? I mean, I suppose taxes could be one.
Of the 2,500 people, and now since then we've done at least more than 1,000 since then, I would suggest that less than 2% are beyond family control. And even those 2% are the result of choices that they made. We all have bumps in our life. And Jim, I'm sure you've had them just as we've had them. And it's not the bump, it's how we react to the bump. And so when the family comes together and builds the trust and communication, have you ever heard of the word cordial hypocrisy? Well, we had a family where mom required all of the kids to be home for dinner every Sunday. And they were in their 30s and 40s, and they wanted to go to their other in-laws once in a while on Sunday, but they didn't want to hurt mom's feelings. They loved her. And so they kept telling their family, sorry, we've got to be at home. When we finally got to the point where we could have that conversation halfway through the second day of one of the family meetings, mom said, I'd rather go back to cordial hypocrisy. And the kids leaned over in unison as if they were trained to do it and said, Mom, we'll never go back to cordial hypocrisy. And she said, I know that, but she said, it sure was easier on me and everybody here on Sunday afternoon. And so what happens is many powerful men, kids say, if Dad Bunny, if he wants to do it, do it, rather than to talk about what's really going on. And for example, here's a great example I saw in the Wall Street Journal, maybe you saw it, Mark Zuckerberg on is going to give away 90% of his estate to charity. What would he do if one of his children was going to be an Albert Schweitzer? Would he throw that baby out with the bathwater? Nobody's asking him those kind of questions because he thinks it's about money. It's not about money. It's about the values. How do we develop those? How do we create centric interests and passions in our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, which I have all up above?
Then why do you think, Roy, that when you have great wealth, as we see in Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, both of them had children. I know Warren, early on in the 70s, passed to each one of his children $300,000 worth of Berkshire Hathaway stock, which is worth a fortune today. They all did something with their life, but the vast majority of the Gates fortune and the Buffett fortune is going to a foundation rather than the family. What do you think is going on there that's different?
Well, first of all, I commend them for that. What a wonderful gift they're giving to society. The issue that I would have with them is how much, and I don't think any because the kids were too young when they started doing it, but at what point in time did they begin to promote the values, include their children in developing a common value, mission, and philanthropy? How do we begin to promote the values that we want to promote and let the children fail and make mistakes and not beat them up? In other words, how do we help the children grow and take risks? Those are the things that are missing so many times. You get fathers or mothers who are control freaks. Well, that's a normal parent protection of my babies. Mama bear protects her cubs. That's a normal. When we don't let our children go down the street without their training wheels on their bike or cross the street by themselves alone until we know they're safe. That's a parent, the thing that we all have as parents, and that's to protect our own.
I'm getting the feeling here, Roy, that's really what is needing here by the founder or the patriarch of the wealth is some form of mentoring process of the next generation.
Yeah, but Jim, here's the problem. Now, are you familiar with sign language?
No.
Let me just help you quickly to give you a quick summary. If you take your right index finger up and push it against the side of your nose, that's called boring in sign language. And years ago, I would be in front of my family talking about business, et cetera, and they'd be just blatantly pushing their finger against the side of their nose. And I said, am I that boring? And they said, Pop, you're boring. What I learned is that I could then bring a coach in and say exactly the same thing I was saying, and they'd say, you know, Dad, he's really bright. Well, what I learned is that parents are role models, good and bad, but we're not coaches. Can you imagine, Jim, trying to teach your wife to drive a car or vice versa? That's not the role of the parents do well. Let's bring in a team of people to help them learn what has to be learned. Jim, you were an investment guy. You have a whole background in investment. If you were going to take the role of money manager and say, okay, Jim, I'd like you to identify the qualification standards, not the legal standards, but the qualification standards that you personally would require to replace you as money manager for your family. And when you finish that list of qualification standards, then I want you to go back and say, what are the performance standards that you'd require that individual? Do you know that most money managers can't do what I just asked you to do? They wouldn't know how to begin. Well, how can we begin to train our children if we don't know how? I asked a father to do that who was the president of a company for 40 years. I said, qualification and performance standards for your role as president. 2 weeks later, he called me and said, Roy, do you know how much work you've caused me? I said, what did I do? He asked me those questions. I said, well, how are you doing? He said, based upon my qualification standards, I don't qualify for the job. And based upon my performance standards, I couldn't apply for the job. Well, I said, how much can you imagine your children and your wife being able to do what you couldn't do for 2 weeks? Impossible. So those are the things that are missing, Jim, that we can begin to inculcate into a family and better prepare them to be better stewards. And it's not about money.
What we find, Jim, is that when we can have conversations with the families about values, they find pretty quickly that the values they all share are more similar than they might realize. And one of the things that was missing is how to have a conversation about that, that really brings the family together instead of pulling them apart. So while the dad and the mom are role models just by the nature of their role as parents, they may not have the skills to talk about it in a way that the family can hear and will build a future together.
Good point.
You know, Amy, you're a listening coach with the Williams Group. As a listening coach, how do you seek to foster trust and communication within the family unit? I mean, you can take a family that may have 4 or 5 children. How do you get them to agree or create this communication, trust, and purpose if it didn't exist when you first met them?
You know, oftentimes what we'll do is we will just do interviews with each of the individual family members, and the trust building begins there. There's a quote, I think it's anonymous, that truly being listened to is an act of love. And many people don't really know how to listen. So in these interviews, people are able to finally speak what they haven't felt like they could say in the past. And they can start to express their desires, their passions, their wants, their concerns, and maybe even start to have the conversations that they've been afraid to have in the past. And so once we get a feel for where everybody's coming from, we start by teaching them how to have these conversations, the tools required so that the conversations build unity. We talk about what is trust, and we talk about how to listen. We talk about our interpretations versus assessments. So we have lots of different tools that we share with them. And once they start to trust themselves and being able to have these conversations in a productive way, it really just kind of pervades the conversation, and they start getting more and more comfortable with a new skill set.
Amy, what about the situation where, let's say, you are having this conversation with young children who are not adults yet? Won't the knowledge of an inheritance affect their drive and work ethic as they look ahead? I mean, let's say you're talking about a family that has hundreds of millions of dollars, or in some cases, billions, because we have so many billionaires in this country. I mean, you know, if I'm a kid, I'm living a good life, I pretty much have anything I want, And I'm finding out that, you know, someday I may be worth several hundred million. The only reason I'm saying that is I came across early on in my career an heir of one of the great Fortune 500 companies and totally irresponsible, never worked a day in his life, didn't really have a value of money or other people's worth. But, you know, here was an individual that was worth probably $250 million.
That's probably hitting the nail on the head of what keeps a lot of the wealthy parents we work with up at night. They fear that the wealth intended to be a source of good in the world will actually cause harm. And how to navigate that with their children is definitely first and foremost when we come to work with them. What I see that works well is the dad learning how to have the conversations around his expectations. And at the same time, a conversation with the younger kids about fair doesn't always mean equal. So it could be that one child is given more because of their needs and where they want to go with their life. And another one who's sitting on the beach in Maui isn't getting the same kind of benefits. And the dad then sets a conversation that says, here are the standards. Here's how this is going to work. Even before that, there's a conversation around who are we as a family? What's the identity we want to build in the world? And how do we uncover the purpose and drive and passion in each of these kids so that they can see a bigger future for themselves?
A couple of observations there. In most cases, we don't even talk about money for a year or so. Money is, again, irrelevant. That's a way of keeping score. And once the kids understand that the definition of wealth is much, much broader, it isn't just money. Now, one of the problems that they have with parents is that the kids are used to being in private jets wherever they go in the world, and they're used to this lifestyle, and they think that's what money does for them. Once they begin to develop their values and mission and purpose for life, they can begin to look at this and say, gee, things don't determine who I am. And what we find is that kids who get involved with philanthropy, and if you look at philanthropy errors and values, that was about 100 family foundations. What we found is that the kids who got involved with philanthropy, the kids had the attitude that the money and things didn't determine who they were. For example, we had kids each year go with Gus Chalomas on kind of like Doctors Without Borders, and he goes, takes 30 nurses, and he usually takes a couple of teenagers as orderlies. And they operate 16-hour days for 10 straight days. And they take portable operating rooms and everything and out into the jungles. When they come back from those kind of adventures, they find that money and things don't determine who they are, but their values determine who and what they are. And we had one young man come back and went home and he said, I'm really upset. I said, why? He said, do you know that you can go to the grocery store and see more groceries in one room than exists in Guatemala in the entire country? He was dumbfounded at the comparison. And so when he learned that money didn't determine who he was.
Yeah, there were other things more important. You know, this reminds me, and I'll get to this in a second, but I want to get a couple questions in here. Amy, when you're in a room with families, what are the biggest obstacles you normally must overcome? That's one question. And then the other is, if you run into an heir that is made aware of his responsibilities to prepare for a large inheritance, but he's simply not interested in philanthropy or doing anything responsible, how do you deal with, in many cases, what we call emotional immaturity?
Yeah, those are great questions. And we do see them in nearly every situation. The big issues that we see in families are connected to that very concern. It's how is the wealth going to support the family in moving forward? And by that we mean, what are the roles that these kids are going to play as the wealth begins to transition? I can tell you with every interview I do with a mom or dad, that's really what they're concerned about because they don't want to have a kid sitting on the beach the rest of his life. And so again, what we often come back to there is really trying to create a space that's safe enough for that kid to begin to explore their passion. So if they're going to sit on the beach, we might start to talk to them about, you know, let's talk about the species that are living in the water where the water is becoming uninhabitable. And that might connect to climate change. And then suddenly there's an interest of, well, how about we look at ways that we can start to impact that? And look at that, we can have this kind of impact and you can track how that is having an effect. And we'll teach them how to make those assessments. And so it's really a question of finding out what they are passionate about and creating a space safe enough for them to express it. Another issue we often find is the kids are embarrassed by their wealth. They really don't know how to live with it in a way that makes sense for them. And so a recent family we worked with, there were 7 or 8 kids, and that was even a topic of conversation that they didn't know how to have. And once we had that conversation, they could see they all share the same concern. And then sure enough, they figured out they all share an interest in going to Africa. So off they went, and they could see that their wealth was this incredible opportunity to build a village and bring running water and put kids in school and build the school. And so suddenly the wealth had a completely different meaning for them, and they were very proud of it. Another issue that we tend to find is people in families don't learn how to have difficult conversations. So the son or the daughter that's in line to move into the family business and has been really shaped and groomed for that since they were born, they haven't figured out how to say, boy, that's really not what I want to do. Or another son or daughter that might not be given that opportunity don't know how to say, I'd love an opportunity at that. So really it comes down to teaching them the tools to have these conversations, not just to solve that particular issue, but so that they can have meaningful conversations for the rest of their lives and a new pattern of communication through the generations. So the fabric of relationship changes because the language changes.
Amy, let me ask you a question. At what point, if you're doing succession planning, what sort of planning is necessary for a successful estate transition? And I guess, when do you start that process? Do you start it early on when the kids are children, or do you wait till they're adults and maybe can understand some of the implications of the enormous wealth? When does that process begin?
That's another great question, and it's one we get often. From our perspective, the sooner you prepare the family for the wealth, the better. And so when a family can work with us or learn the tools to be able to speak about the values and be able to exemplify how to have the conversations that need to happen in a family so that there is openness, so that when an interpretation happens, for example, maybe the mom or dad is starting to feel like, boy, my kid is not going in the right direction. They're starting to say, I want to go to a private school, or I want a faster car, or I want fancier clothes. That can sometimes open the conversations. We encourage that the conversations happen much sooner. The place to look for whether or not they're ready to have these conversations are around the dinner table, where they talk about, here's who we are as a family, and here's what we care about, and this is the kind of good we see that our wealth can do in the world. So it's not about the money. It's about the possibilities and the opportunities that can get created. It's about how their legacy gets exemplified and actionable in the world. So it really starts very early, and it's about the investment in the future of the children, but not an investment in the financial, right? It's an investment in how do we want to organize for generations to come? And that's a different kind of investment than what they might be used to. So to answer your question, as soon as possible.
I think what you're implying here, too, this is an ongoing dialogue that begins with young children. So you instill those values in them over time rather than, let's say, wait for a situation where you think, okay, they're mature enough now, let's lay this on them. Because chances are, as you mentioned earlier in the conversation, when you have that kind of wealth, the kids are used to, you know, having anything they want. They travel around the world in private jets. They have house servants. I mean, obviously they know they're living a privileged life unless, you know, the only people they hang around with are people similar to their own situation.
Exactly. And so it's through the conversations of what is wealth. Is it just money, or is it what possibilities or the ways they can impact the world? It's talking about the shared value. It's about what do we want to be, or who do we want to be as a family, and what identity do we want to have in the community? And how do we agree on that? That's really where the leverage is in how wealth transfers successfully. There is an education component about how to empower the children to be wise stewards of the family wealth. That's a different conversation than let's talk about how we're going to just increase how much money we have. And that's a different conversation than how much money each kid is going to get. It's rooted much more deeply in the identity and the legacy and the values that really shaped the wealth in the first place. That's where the leverage is.
Finally, Amy, in your book, you have a checklist for heirs' readiness. The first one, has a family wealth mission been developed with the involvement of the entire family and their spouses? It's kind of like a corporate statement of mission. Many corporations have this. And essentially here, you're doing the same thing. But in this case, you're talking about a wealthy family and the mission of that family and its wealth.
Exactly. And that's really a fundamental piece of the pie here. When we can build enough trust in a family to be able to talk about what do they see the future to be? How do they want their kids to grow up with wealth? What's the way that they want to move towards the future with the wealth so that it's a force of unity and pride in the family? And that mission statement is the roadmap for how they're going to get there. Once we do a mission statement with the family, it's built on these values, and it has aspects to it that are directly lived by the family. So, for example, one mission statement might say, one thing we're committed to a family is education. And so we'll then work with them on saying, okay, if it's education, what does that mean? Does that mean we'll cover 4 years? Does that mean you can go to any university you want for as long as you want? Or is there a GPA required? Or is there a cap on how much? Does that mean they fly first class across the country? So we'll work with them to articulate how does the rubber meet the road with this actual mission statement. So it's not just an idea. It's something that they live by.
Are there specific observable and measurable standards in place to determine the qualifications for each role? In other words, education, experience, family relationship. I mean, you know, if somebody isn't equated with wealth, finances, the implications of how money's made and maintained, I mean, I think that would be as important as well.
Oh, that's really important. Because if the person who assumes the role doesn't really understand what everybody else's expectations are, then it could be that they end up not performing at the level the rest of the family expects. And that can have consequences for everyone, and it can start to breed, again, what we call cordial hypocrisy, where there hasn't been an agreed upon standard or performance expectation. So by the family actually talking about what does it mean to run the family foundation, and if one of the family members wants to step into that, then they as a unit talk about, well, what are our expectations? What do we want to see happen? How will we know if they're being successful? What are the qualifications? How long can they hold that role? And that way we avoid situations where somebody just gets into the position because it's obligatory. So that is an incredibly important aspect of when we talk about roles. What is the role? How does it affect the family? What are the qualifications and standards? Very important. They also use that for learning how to be good stewards. So there might be someone who is responsible for deciding which foundation they want to give money to. And a person in the family might be responsible for figuring out whether or not the family's finances are going to the actual cause, or if it's having an impact, or if that foundation is being run efficiently. So here again, they start to be responsible for their wealth instead of just giving it away like that.
Well, it's a really great, great book. The name of the book is called Preparing Heirs, Five Steps to a Successful Transition of Family Wealth and Values. I was really surprised to hear about your and Roy's book. I didn't realize that there was an organization or a company like yourselves that specialize in basically life coaching wealthy families. A rather unique niche.
Yeah, thank you. It is a really unique niche. And I think one of the things that allows us to do this work in this unique positioning is that we're not actually managing people's money. We're not preparing the assets for the family. We're preparing the family for the asset. And so it's really unique and advantageous to us to work on really just the level of trust and communication family. Because it's really not about the money. It's about family unity and skill and having conversations that build trust.
Well, listen, I want to thank both you and Roy for joining us on Lifetime Income. Great, great book. Once again, it's called Preparing Heirs, Five Steps to a Successful Transition of Family Wealth and Values by Roy Williams and Vic Prizer. Thank you so much, Amy and Roy.
Thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
You know, a lot of times you wonder, given especially tax structures and everything else, people had great estates and how they were able to successfully pass them on. And then there were also other cases, like we've talked about, where it really resulted in disaster. The estate was just squandered away within a generation or two. And with planning, you can do what you need to do.
Yeah, and as we talked about there with Roy Williams, it's not just the tax planning. There's got to be family unity. There's got to be a purpose behind things. And all of that goes together because, you know, in the case of the Vanderbilts, there wasn't that unity and purpose. And so the wealth was dissipated. The second generation dissipated most of it. There wasn't much left by the time you got to the third generation. So like the case study that we were talking about, the Grants, you're talking about, John, the way things are set up right now, that someday this legacy is going to be over $100 million for a future generation. I mean, think of all the good and purpose that there is behind it. So it's more than just tax planning that goes into it. So, you know, if you are fortunate enough to be in that situation, I recommend Roy Williams's book, Preparing Heirs, Five Steps to a Successful Transition of Family Wealth and Values. And I also recommend the movie, The Ultimate Gift. It is just a fabulous movie. You'll love it. It's a great movie to watch during the holidays. I watch it every Christmas time. It's just an uplifting, great, great movie that I'm sure that you'll really appreciate and may inspire you the way it inspired the author who wrote the book on which the movie was based. Well, in the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.